Welcome to the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome to the Keystone Kickoff Show. I am Jim Galante. He is Dustin Schutte. Fresh off a 4th of July weekend trip. How was your holiday, Dustin?
I still have all 10 fingers, Jim, so it was a pretty good holiday for me. I am scared of fire. I mean, I like fireworks, but I do not like the like homegrown fireworks, so I stay away from those. But it was good. It was good. It was a lot of just kind of relaxing and getting together with people. So it was good. How was yours?
Not too bad. Pretty quiet, but I ate well and. All ten fingers. No one's calling me stubby. I survived. I'm with you. I absolutely love fireworks. Love fireworks. I lived in D.C. for a couple years right out of college. That 4th of July, first it's a concert by the Beach Boys, and then major fireworks. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. I always love that. Just a side note, I always have to bring this up when I talk about those couple 4th of Julys where I was in D.C. Have you ever visited D.C.?
Yes, one time.
Okay. By any chance, did you go on the subway?
No, we did not. We were on a bus.
Okay. Great subway system, especially back then when I lived there, 40 years ago. New. It was what a great way to get around town. It was the first place where they had the machines, the little card, the mag strip on it to get it. Fantastic. Well, come 4th of July, when they had, millions of people show up on D.C. for the 4th, the celebration, the subway system can get overwhelmed. Plus, everybody new in town trying to figure out how the machines work. It could be a nightmare. On the 4th, they changed it into an honor system. Okay. I have no idea if they still do this. Okay. But there's several train stations, subway stations right downtown. So after the fireworks, everybody leaves at the exact same time. It's like could be an absolute nightmare. But what they do, I've never seen a city actually do stuff this well logistically. They have all the trains sitting at those couple stations. And even though the crowd is like up the stairs and out the door, all the trains are sitting there waiting. The honor system, they take out the turnstile, they open it up. You could literally just walk in and get on the train, but they would have big garbage cans. It was a voluntary donation. I think it was like a dollar or whatever it was. You just threw your dollar in the bucket. I never saw anyone not do the donation.
Oh, wow.
And when we left, the first time I was down there and they did this, and you're like out on the street in line, just to get into the station, it's like, my God, we're going to be here all night. It'll be morning before we get on a train. Nope. Because they were all there lined up, shooting people out. It was so efficient. Now, I guess they had practice over the years, Dustin, but incredible logistics, especially for a city. City governments usually don't work this well.
No, and maybe we should, now nothing would ever get that. First of all, somebody would steal the trash. Nobody would pay, and somebody would steal the trash bin full of dollar bills now.
Probably.
So I'll tell you two quick things. Number one is that my only trip to D.C. was when I was in junior high, and do you know when that was? It was right after 9/11.
Oh, wow.
I tell you, we could do nothing. I mean, we would go in line, and the line, you would allocate, 2 or 3 hours. The line was so long to get in everywhere that because of all the security and all that stuff, I bet we'd spend a half an hour. Some of us, if they were at the front of the line, might be in there for an hour and a half, but other of us were in there for 15 minutes and it was time to leave. Second part is, some of my favorite 4th of Julys was when I lived in Florida. I lived in Orlando, close to where we could hear the fireworks from the Magic Kingdom every night. Well, if you went over to where my mom lived at that time, you would walk out of her front door, go onto the street, and if you walked, it would be a straight line from her place to the castle at Magic Kingdom. So on the 4th of July, we just went over to her house, stood in the street, watched the fight, a perfect view, and you don't have to fight any of the any of the traffic or any of the people. So it was pretty awesome, because those fireworks, not probably as good as DC, but they were pretty good.
Oh, and I've been down there for that also. It's fantastic. But see, now you and I start telling stories, and I will tell, I promise, my last story, because it's related to both of the stories you told, believe it or not. It's related to both Disney and to 9/11. You said you were in D.C. on 9/11. I was in Orlando. And we had flown down there, long story why, but we're going to do all the Disney stuff. We actually were on 9/11 itself. We went somewhere other than the parks. And we went, and there was like a handwritten note that said, "We're closed today." And it's like, that seems strange. So we're driving back towards the parks, and they had the temporary signs, you know, on the interstate. All parks are closed. And we're like, what's going on? Well, finally, we get somewhere or turn on the radio. We hear what happened. We were perhaps the last people to find out. Well, then, guess what? I was supposed to leave the next day.
Mm.
You don't hop on a plane right on 9/12, Dustin. Right. And the other part to it is a lot of folks, of course, had rental cars. So they just hopped into the Hertz or Avis rental car, drove back to the Northeast, up to Pennsylvania, New York, wherever, and hey, just paid the price of turning their car in at another place. Me, in my infinite wisdom, when we arrived at the airport, for some crazy lines at every rental car spot, except one, some local rental car place, like Joe's Rental Car. The cars are the same. I'm not going to wait in line for an hour. So I got a Joe's rental car from Orlando. Well, guess what? I can't drive Joe's rental car back home because there's no place to turn it back in. And that is the only time in my life that I did that. Rented and, you know, from a no-name company. So stuck in Orlando for 3 or 4 days. Finally, when the airport opens, you talk about lines, Dustin.
Oh boy,
that security line, it was absolutely crazy. I don't know how many hours waiting in line, 3, 4, 5 hours, whatever. It was not a good feeling. And it wasn't so great also climbing into a plane, you know, right there.
I'm sure, yeah. I can't imagine that.
Yeah. Eyeballing every other passenger in the plane, you know.
Yeah.
But we made it back. All right. How about we talk about some college football, Dustin? What do you think?
That sounds great.
Let's start with some Penn State news. Khalil Taylor, wide receiver from the state of Pennsylvania. He made the choice to go to Nebraska, ironically, the state of Nebraska, where you were this past weekend. And he made the choice. Part of the story with him was, Dustin, sat there. It was between Nebraska and Penn State, had the hats lined up, picked up the Penn State hat. I'm going to the University of Penn State. Before he throws the Penn State hat aside, puts on the Nebraska hat. Maybe I'm bitter, but I know that's unlike me. But this hat thing, it wasn't all that amusing when it started years ago. I think it's even less amusing now.
Yeah, and the thing about that to me, Jim, is I don't care for it either. Part of me is like, it's just kids being kids. So I, you know, dismiss it a little bit. The other part of it too is like, okay, but what happens if you enter the transfer portal? You know, coaches have to maintain good relationships with players. And I don't know much, you know, I don't follow too closely a lot of the recruiting. I did know this because, you know, of the closeness of it in my household. But that's the one thing. I think, you know, maybe a few years ago it was I don't want to say fine, but it was okay. Well, that's where the kid's going to play college football and whatever, had a little fun with it. But now you don't know what's going to happen one year to the next. And if you're running, you know, I don't know who Matt Campbell, he might say, all right, well, we're not going to have any relationship with that kid moving forward. You know, so I don't know. It's just, you don't, in this day of college football, I don't know why you'd want to burn any bridges. And maybe he didn't. Maybe you just chalk it up to, you know, being a kid or whatever. But that's the one thing that I think about with some of these anymore is, you know, back in the day, it wasn't a big thing. Maybe it adds to a rivalry, or maybe it makes that game a little bit more intense or whatever. No big deal. But now you don't know. We don't know what's happening from one year to the next. So you'd want to maintain as many open lines of communication with as many coaching staffs as you possibly could. So that's the one thing. But I'm also not in it personally. I'm sure if I was a fan of Penn State, I might be a little more irritated about it.
Well, the thing about it is, and I've seen this happen with players who commit to Penn State, and to be honest, I didn't like that either.
Yeah.
But, you know, my take, and your reaction, hey, they're kids, that's the normal reaction, or you hear that reaction a lot. And one of the differences is this isn't a normal 17-year-old kid who's going to go off to college and one day he's going to drink a beer when he's underage and, well, kids will be kids, you know. Right. But they're now in the national spotlight. And now they're being paid not like grown-ups. They're being paid like rich grown-ups. And there's certain responsibilities that come with that. And I always try to relate what's going on with players to what happens in the real world. If you're, you know, out interviewing for jobs and you make a decision to go with company A over company B, you don't spit on company B. Right. You never know. Things might not work out at company A. In fact, you go out of your way to be nice to company B, knowing you may need them one time in the future. So I think even if you don't want to blame the kids, I think you've got to talk to the people around them, the adults. And they do have adults. They have parents, uncles, agents, people who are helping them with all of those things. And if they're not advising the kid well enough, forget it. Dustin, we're going to have one more note on that commitment before we get on to our next topic right after this.
Welcome to the new HVU Insider, Penn State football's fan scouting platform providing exclusive recruiting intel, the first of its kind platform giving Penn State fans an inside look at how the Nittany Lions identify, evaluate, and recruit the next generation of talent, led by Mike B and powered by Penn State students. It's a new era of Penn State football under Coach Matt Campbell. You can sign up at happyvalleyunited.com. It's fast and free.
It's quarter number two on the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. It's quarter number two. He's Dustin Schutte. I'm Jim Galante. We are talking college football. Penn State lost in my little tirade about Khalil Taylor doing the picking up the Penn State hat before tossing it. I don't want to forget, he's a good wide receiver from the state of Pennsylvania, and Penn State has lost out on quite a number of good players, specifically in the state of Pennsylvania. But before we get on talking about how the recruiting process works, I just want to mention one other thing that just, and it's been going on for years, even with players who choose to go to Penn State. A little bit of advice, if there's any recruits out there who are listening to this show and are contemplating going to Penn State, it's Penn State University.
Yeah.
It is not University of Penn State. Okay? Right. And I know you want to draw out that drama, I'm going to take my talents to the University of. No, it's not the University of Penn State. Okay. Just like it's not the University of Ohio State. Right. Ohio State University, Penn State University. Just a note. Okay.
I've heard that a lot with Purdue. It's Purdue University, not University of Purdue.
Yeah, it shouldn't be tough to figure out. You know, they gave you swag. I'm sure nothing on it said University of Purdue.
Right, right.
Again, is there not an adult in the room who might be able to help you out? But
fact check a little bit.
Just a little, Dustin. That's all. Just a little. That's all we ask. Anyway, let's move on. I want to talk about this Khalil Taylor commitment in a little different context. Penn State, again, big changes, Matt Campbell coming in. And Khalil Taylor is not the first high-profile recruit tied to the University of Penn State, and then has moved on either after committing or prior to committing. And, you know, I could add a couple. Jameer Dean, four-star, wide receiver. Penn State got him when he was still a three-star, got upgraded, came in demand, moved on to Georgia, came in spell, five-star running back, tied to Penn State. There were crystal balls for him, ended up committing to Georgia. Peter Bork, quarterback. High-profile contest, Penn State, Virginia Tech, and Georgia, ended up going with Virginia Tech. The feeling on all of these is they went for more money, and I don't blame any of the players for doing that. I mean, in our, again, using any profession in the private sector, people often change jobs to go for more money. But it leads me to the question, it feels like Penn State recruiting is going for value and that they're not gonna quote unquote overpay for a player. It's the philosophical question for you, Dustin. Can you win that way? Or at some point do you have to say, man, this guy is just too valuable to us, it's time to overpay?
Yeah, I think if you feel really good about the player. Now, there are a couple different aspects to this. Number one is there an in-house philosophy where you don't want to create any locker room drama and say, you know what, we could give this kid $1 million, but we don't want to pay anybody more than $750 because we want the distribution to be a little bit more even. That way we don't have any locker room issues. Because if you have some, and the reason I say that, Jim, is because I do think that there are probably some players worth a lot of money. But if you have star wide receiver X who, you know, is a freshman expected to start and makes, let's say, $1 million, and you've got junior wide receiver making $500K, and then junior wide receiver ends up having the better season, well, then all of a sudden it's like, why the hell am I not making that kind of money? Or the demand goes up and then you may see trades. So there may be a philosophy to it of, you know, hey, we are willing to pay, but we want to see you produce first. We're not going to pay you for your potential. So I think there's a little bit of that going on. But if there's a kid that you just feel really good about, that this is going to be the difference maker, the guy, and that's why I think you'd be more, I would bet more coaches are willing to overpay from the transfer portal, because at least those kids have proven, as opposed to the recruiting, you know, the high school recruit. Now, this is where I think, like, at places maybe like USC, Texas, Oklahoma, maybe boosters get involved and say, no, you're going to offer that five-star kid this amount of money because we need him, because there's a prestige value. And I think a lot of those people get involved in the recruiting aspect, whether that's permitted or not. So I think there's a couple different factors involved there, but it's kind of like the NFL draft, right? You don't know if you overpaid for a player until probably 2 or 3 years down the road. You know, that first year you get them in the door and maybe they're not ready to produce, but in a couple seasons, maybe he's your star player. Maybe he's an all conference, all, you know, first round pick, whatever the case might be. And I always go back to this example too, Jim, is if you don't feel good about players, do you set aside that money and use them for the next recruiting class, for the next transfer portal class? Barry Odom's first year, they didn't feel good about what they were going to get in the transfer portal. So they withheld dollars and put it towards this year because they just felt like, you know what, there's not anybody that's really standing out that's interested. We're just trying to assemble a roster, and coming off of no wins, a one-win season, no wins in the Big Ten, we need to get bodies in here, and we don't want to pay, you know, guy from Sam Houston State, you know, $500,000 if we think he's going to be the second string linebacker. So I think that there is now, and that's why I think the general manager position is so important, because you've got to identify talent. You got to identify, I hate to say identify worth, because can you measure the worth? But in terms of your production, you can. So I think there's just so many factors here, but I would bet that the locker room aspect is a big one, because you don't want to pay, you don't want to pay a guy X amount based on potential. Now, if he's proven himself, you can say, look, this guy's had 2 1,000-yard receiving seasons. We need him. So if you have that level of production, this is what you can make. But right now, that's why there's such a wide gap between what he's making and what you're making.
Well, Matt Campbell has said exactly that. So, Dustin, you're ready to be a big-time college football coach.
If I can get fired and get one of those buyouts, I'll sign up immediately.
Be like Ed Ogeron. Hey, they're paying me a boatload of money not to coach. I'll take it. The conversation, and I'm sure it's very different at Purdue than at Penn State. No offense, but Purdue's in a different position. But I think for everybody, there's that sense, if you're going to pay big money to a kid coming in out of high school, knowing he's going to sit. Now, you mentioned the NFL. There's a pay standard, and, you draft the quarterback, number one. Everybody knows what you offer and what the dollars are, what the years are, and they know he's going to sit for a year and not play. It's wasted money in the first year. The difference is in college, that same kid that you're paying all that money in year one, he could be gone in year two.
Right. Well, I was just going to say, you've got two examples that I can think of off the top of my head. I'm sure there's a lot more, but you could look at probably Dylan Raiola at Nebraska. You know, there was a lot of pressure to bring him in, probably spent too much. I don't know what the number is, so maybe they didn't. But 2 years, and then he leaves the program and goes to Oregon. Now, there were some other circumstances there where his uncle wasn't going to be brought back. So there you have, do you feel like you lost on that investment? The other example would be Brendan Sorsby, right? You pay $5 million, and then all of a sudden you're dealing with a gambling problem, and he's not able to play for you. So there's a couple examples there of you spend a lot of money and you think you know what you're getting, but that's a situation where even in the transfer portal, even a guy that's proven, what kind of baggage are you bringing with you to the program? So you've got to be diligent in your research, in your homework. And then if I'm going to overspend or if I'm going to pay a lot of money, I'd prefer it to be out of the transfer portal versus a high school recruit. Because like you said, what are the chances that you're going to stay? Now, maybe if you pay him well up front, he stays. But Jim, how many of those five-star quarterbacks end up transferring? I bet it's got to be 75%, if not higher.
Well, I did this several years ago, Dustin, where I looked up like over a seven-year span, there were 15 five-star quarterbacks. Okay, this was before the portal, before transferring was so prevalent. Over half of them, I believe, transferred, which back in that day meant they failed. Okay, right. So you're right. And I think what's important is an awareness of where your program is. You brought up a great example with Purdue, where they were last year. It's like a rebuilding team in baseball. Hey, we're going to trade off all our big salary guys, start the rebuild. Makes no sense to have those huge contracts. But now I'll, go back to the NFL. Running backs have been devalued in the NFL.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But a couple years ago, Howie Roseman, GM of the Eagles, said, you know what? Saquon Barkley can be the difference between us being a good team and a great team, a Super Bowl winner. Which is exactly what they turned out to be. Saquon Barkley meant so much more to Philadelphia with a fantastic offensive line than it did the New York Giants, whose offensive line was god awful.
Right.
Didn't matter if he was the best running back in the sport or not. That was the wrong time to spend the extra money. So there's that. But, you know, I think the bigger question is, you know, value. You place value on the talent, on money, and can you do that now? Could you actually win big if you're not, if you're sticking to your guns and the value of players?
Yeah, I think you, and the reason I say I think you can is because at some point you're going to have to pay that money, whether that's in terms of retention or going out and getting those one or two guys that you feel like are the difference between you being a playoff team and being a championship caliber team. So again, if you are Penn State and you have a receiver who has 1,200 yards, and all of a sudden Ohio State comes knocking at the door, Texas comes knocking at the door, Alabama, Indiana now, let's throw them in the mix. If you have some of those guys that are knocking, Matt Campbell may say, we need, like, this guy is a key part of our offense. How much extra can we pay him? That's where I think, again, maybe you overspend, maybe you don't, but I think if you have a guy making 250 and all of a sudden people are offering him 500,000, and I'm just throwing out numbers.
Yeah.
I know you gave me but I think that it you will spend that money at some point.
All right, Dustin, that is it for quarter number two.
Welcome to the new HVU Insider, Penn State football's fan scouting platform providing exclusive recruiting intel, the first of its kind platform giving Penn State fans an inside look at how the Nittany Lions identify, evaluate, and recruit the next generation of talent. Led by Mike V and powered by Penn State students, it's a new era of Penn State football under Coach Matt Campbell. You can sign up at happyvalleyunited.com. It's fast and free.
Let's get back to the action on the Keystone Kickoff Show. Brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. It's quarter number three. He's Dustin. I'm Jim. We're talking college football. Dustin, the first two segments between talking fireworks and a bit about recruiting. Now I want to shift gears with you, have a little bit of fun. And maybe this is a little bit me as an old guy with nostalgia for, you know, what the game was like previously. And I was just wondering, we know the game has changed so much, so completely in the last couple of years. We know what money has done, the transfer portal, changes in the conferences. Some of these things are good, some of them not so good. But I want to just ask you, what changes or what things that used to be, like you grew up with watching college football. I did too. We're different generations. But are there things that are gone now that I'm not saying, gee, the game would be better off if it still had them, but they're just things that you miss from the game?
Yes. I'm going to go back to something you said last season, actually, because it resonates with me, not every day, but often. So there you go, Jim. You're in my mind every week.
I'm living rent-free in your head, Dustin.
I remember... and we were watching this game as it unfolded in the press box at Purdue. The Penn State Indiana game, after James Franklin had been fired, you know, Indiana, I think they were I think they were ranked number two at the time, or not, they were a top five team for sure. And Penn State probably played their best football game of the season. And if I remember correctly, Drew Aller was not available, or he got hurt in that game. I don't remember which.
He was already out.
Okay, so he was already out. So Penn State played an outstanding game. They lose on that ridiculous catch by Omar Cooper. Just a great football game. And the thing you said was, it reminded me of the old days because everybody was just invested in that game. Playoff was out of the picture. Big Ten championship game out of the picture. You know that there's going to be a reconstruction of the program, you know, in the offseason. So everybody was just invested in that game. And for 60 minutes, it kind of felt like, you know, the 80s or the 90s in terms of college, maybe even early, you know, just everybody was so focused on game day. It was a great tailgate, you know, atmosphere, all this stuff. That's what I miss more than anything. And I think that when you're at the stadium, and I'd be interested on your take, but like when I'm at the stadium, even though I'm covering the games and I'm not sitting there cheering or, you know, enjoying tailgates or whatever because I have to work, there's still a, the rest of the world is shut off. You are just in that environment and you're focused on that game. And that was the beauty of college football. The problem now to me is every week, and I, because I think that the media, this is probably me included, because I used to be in this position where I was covering the entire Big Ten, everything is so playoff centric from opening week until the very end of the season. And I don't know if there's another sport, there probably is, but where I don't even think you get this in college basketball. People mention like the, this could be a Final Four team.
Yeah.
You don't get that. You don't get the, if they win this, they're playoff bound in week one, like you do in college football. We have just put such a priority on the playoff that it almost diminishes the enjoyment of some of those games. Now, I think, again, I think I'm probably in a little bit different position because now at some point this may change. We don't know what Barry Odom can do. But right now, nobody in West Lafayette's thinking about the playoff. Just, can we get to six wins? Can we get to bowl?
Yeah.
So you take each game at face value, right? Like you would just enjoy the atmosphere. You enjoy the game. You hope it's going to be at least competitive, right? So to me, that's the thing I miss. I remember growing up and just going to those games and being focused on that game at hand. Oh, they're playing number 14 Wisconsin. Can they get an upset? Oh, they beat number 10 Ohio State at home. What a great victory that is. And I don't, and maybe it's because part of me was obviously a kid, but I remember even in high school, like I never thought about the end of the season. I was always hoping they'd get to six wins to watch them in a bowl game, but there was never like this national championship or bust, or, you know, BCS or bust. Now I'm sure at Penn State, Ohio State, Alabama, there was probably always on their mind, but there, I don't feel like there was ever the same sort of importance placed on the postseason from the opening week as much as there is now. It's nonstop and it drives me nuts.
Dustin, that's an excellent one. And you're right about the Indiana game last season. And I was in the press box. It was fascinating to me. The press box, there's the rules, you know, it's sacred.
Yeah.
You don't cheer in the press box. And in that Indiana game, as it was going towards the end, there were writers there that I know are very stoic and cynical and all the things writers are supposed to be. They were standing up. They were like in the aisle, pacing, nervous, anxious. And I don't think it was because they were rooting for Penn State. You know, they just don't do that. But they were like, this is just a damn good football game. And they were, you know, on the edge of their seat so much that they were standing. There was actually an announcement made about, remember, you're in the press box, there's no cheering. And it wasn't cheering noise, but it was noise because of what was, they were oohing and aahing, incredible plays, so much going on, so much drama. And they were reacting to it. So that was an excellent one. It was a great point. And it's funny, too, you know, conference championships have become, you know, over the years, what teams were aiming for before playoffs became so prevalent. What was fascinating to me is I went back and, you know, I picked 1982, which is a sacred year for Penn State fans. Their first national championship. But just finding some things that were going on then. Let me give you a list that I want you to react to. Penn State, Pitt, Florida State, West Virginia, BC, Miami, Virginia Tech, Notre Dame, Georgia Tech, South Carolina, Syracuse. What do all those teams have in common?
Were they? Oh, boy. I was going to say that they were all in the Big East, but Penn State was not. I don't know. Tell me.
They were all independents.
Okay. Well, I was at least close in terms of what you were getting at.
But so the world was different. Obviously, you know, Penn State was playing for national championships. Right. As an independent, that's what the games mattered. But you kind of looked at each game differently than, you know, what does this have to do with the conference standings? Well, nothing, because you're not in a conference. You could have made a heck of a conference just taking all the independent teams. You know, at the time, you know, Pitt was a contender. Florida State was just about to get there. You had Miami, Notre Dame, Georgia Tech. That changed the game that they're all or almost all in conferences now. And I don't know if I want to say better or worse, Dustin, but there were things about that I really liked. Following Penn State specifically, they got to do things differently as an independent. Listen to their schedule, or half the schedule, in 1982. They played Nebraska, Alabama, West Virginia, Notre Dame, Pitt, and Georgia. Now, you might say, Pitt was a top 10 team at the time. West Virginia was ranked 13th in the country at the time. Alabama, they played. Nebraska, when they played them, they were the number two team in the country at that time. Is that not an amazing schedule?
That's a fantastic schedule, yes.
And by the way, just for a lot of folks, especially prior to that, ridiculed Penn State's schedule playing Eastern football. That 1982 national championship team, that schedule was ruled the toughest in the country. They were the first national champion to play the toughest schedule in the country that year also.
Wow. That's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, well, they beat the number one, number two, number four, and number five teams in the country.
That's pretty good.
Well, let me give you something else that existed in 1982 that doesn't exist now. Something called the Southwest Conference.
Yeah.
Are you old enough to remember that at all?
No. I mean, I know about it because I watch enough documentaries and stuff, but I don't remember it being alive.
Listen to this conference. Texas, Texas Tech, Texas A&M, Baylor, SMU, who was a power back then, Arkansas, TCU. It was essentially all the teams that were in the state of Texas plus Arkansas.
Yeah.
That was a pretty cool conference.
Yeah. I would love to see that sort of regionality come back. Because, I mean, you develop every game, probably every week felt like some sort of rivalry game. Maybe not the biggest rivalry, but to an extent, it probably felt like, I mean, you just think about the old Big Ten. I know the Big Eight. Like, I remember the Big Eight days. Like, every game in there felt like it was a rivalry. The old Big Ten, it maybe not quite to the same extreme, but it felt like there were a lot more rivalry type games in those. So I know this isn't the point you're talking about, but the smaller conferences are something else I miss, when you would basically play, maybe you would miss that you'd get that one year and you wouldn't have to play Ohio State, and that helped your chances of winning a Big Ten title. But now it's just, you don't even play half your conference anymore.
Well, that's another great point. At the time, the Big Ten had 10 teams. They played 9 conference games, which means they played everybody in their conference. What was more fascinating, see, this is turning into a little bit of an exercise of what I found out, just doing a little bit of homework. The Southeast Conference had 10 teams.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how many conference games they played?
Boy, I'm going to guess 7.
Very close. 6.
Jeez. Okay. Even then they were cowards.
Well, it was different. Let me give you another one as we finish up this segment, and we'll do more in the fourth quarter, but how about tie games?
Do I miss those?
Yeah.
Not really, but I don't have a problem with a tie game if I'm a viewer. If I would have went to a game when there was a tie, I think I would leave upset.
Well, as we're up against the break, when we come back though, Dustin, I'm going to tell you why I miss tie games. And that this is not me saying I want to go back to that. Okay.
Sure.
Just to understand, But there was an element of tie games that I really did enjoy. And why they might not be the worst idea now. We'll do that when we come back.
Welcome to the new HVU Insider, Penn State football's fan scouting platform providing exclusive recruiting intel, the first of its kind platform giving Penn State fans an inside look at how the Nittany Lions identify, evaluate, and recruit the next generation of talent. Led by Mike V and powered by Penn State students, it's a new era of Penn State football under Coach Matt Campbell. You can sign up at happyvalleyunited.com. It's fast and free.
We head to the home stretch in quarter number four on the Keystone Kickoff Show. Brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. He's Dustin, I'm Jim. We're talking college football, and we're kind of going into our way back machine, looking back in the years previously in college football and what we miss about it. I mentioned the tie game, and I'm probably with you, Dustin. I don't want that rule back. But here's the interesting thing. Your team is behind 14-7. Score a late touchdown. It's now 14-13. What do? Well, it's obvious now. You kick the extra point and you go in overtime. That's what happens. It's a no-brainer. It's easy. Back in the day, though, Dustin, what do you do?
Yeah.
What do you do? Are you going to be a gutless coward and play for the tie? Or are you going to go for it?
Yeah. Oh, man. See, but the mindset was so different back then. Like a tie, maybe national champions, but there were a lot of teams back then that a tie didn't necessarily, I don't want to say didn't hurt you, but it wasn't grounded. So a tie is obviously better than a loss.
It could protect you. And as long as we're going into the way back machine, Dustin, a young little Jimmy was 6 years old when the first game of the century was going on. The two football powers, Notre Dame and Michigan State. 1966, they finished in a tie because that coward, Eric Parsegian, ran the clock out instead of trying to score, and he played for a 10-10 tie. And that was the last time I had any respect for that program, Dustin. I was 6 years old when that happened. Now let's just fast forward a couple years to the 1969 Orange Bowl, Penn State versus Kansas. Score 14-7. Penn State scores a late touchdown, makes it 14-13. Ties could happen. Undefeated season for Penn State. What do you think Joe Paterno did?
Did he go for it? I don't know.
He went for it. And you know what happened?
They got it?
There's only two options, Dustin. No, they didn't. However, Kansas had 12 men on the field, so they got a retry, and they made it. My point being, it was pretty exciting to see a coach have to make a decision, earn their millions of dollars, Dustin, make a decision. So that was one of my issues with that.
You know what? So I'm going to mention, this is the only tie I remember in my lifetime. And I don't know if there's recollection of this. I'm trying to actually find it on the move. But Purdue and Michigan State played in a game in 1995. And I thought Michigan State was, I don't know if they were undefeated. I feel like they were in the Big Ten hunt. And the game was tied at 35-35, and I'm going to have to see if I can find video of it now. I want to say the game was played at Ross-Ade Stadium. I want to say Purdue fans rushed the field after they tied the game. Maybe I'm thinking of a year later when they beat Michigan State, but I have a memory of Purdue tying Michigan State and fans being on the field and, like, storming the goalposts. That should tell you something about how dire Purdue was back in the day. I mean, they are now, but – I feel like I have that correct. I'm going to see if I can find that. If I do, I'll send it to you.
Well, there's a different standard for each team, but you mock them a bit by saying they stormed the field because of a tie. In Penn State's 1994 undefeated season, they were crushing everybody. They had an unstoppable offense. They were crushing Indiana on the road, pulled out their starters. They weren't going to run up the score any more than it already was. And Indiana scored two late touchdowns. Like, I think the last one was like on the last play of the game. And their fans stormed the field because they stayed in the game. They lost, right. Got their butt kicked until the very end. But while you're looking up your Purdue game, let me give you something else that I miss from back in the day. All the big bowl games on New Year's Day. Yeah. And it wasn't like – and you know I'm an advocate for the playoffs. Love the playoffs.
Yeah.
But back in the day where you could have the winners of those bowl games felt really good about themselves. It wasn't a national championship or bust. But I looked at this schedule, the 1982 New Year's Day. Cotton Bowl was on at noon, and at the time it was a big deal. The Southwest Conference winner would host that. The Fiesta Bowl was on at 1:30, the Rose Bowl at 4:30, and both the Sugar Bowl and Orange Bowl were both on that evening. Greatest day in sports all year, Dustin, was New Year's Day.
Yeah, I miss that too. And you know, I think I've told you now, it's probably different again in a lot of schools, like, you know, Penn State, Nebraska, Ohio State, where they wanted to win national championships. But that winning that bowl game, well, first of all, getting to the Rose Bowl, it didn't matter if you were, you know, if you were 8-3, but you got into the Rose Bowl, that's a successful season. Again, for 90% of the Big Ten, probably not Ohio State, Michigan, and to an extent Penn State, to win, you know, just getting to the Rose Bowl and winning that game. But I like that was the national championship for a lot of teams in the Big Ten, you know. So to me, and then playing in that game, it almost, you wanted to win, but it almost didn't matter. Like, you got to the Rose Bowl. What a big deal that is. And so I miss that. I remember those, you know, 2 weeks. It was just like whatever they used to call it, Bowl Mania or whatever, ESPN, where you just seemed like for a 2 week stretch, you'd have, you know, every big game or every bowl game was on, you'd watch. And it felt, yeah, everybody was playing. You might see some upsets. You had the Boise State Oklahoma game where Boise State upset Oklahoma, and I think that was the Fiesta Bowl. But it was just awesome. And now I don't want to say I could but care less, but I don't tune in. I watch the Pop-Tart Bowl. but then you're right. Everything, the biggest games on New Year's Day, kind of ending with that. And I think there was, you know, I think January 8th, I always think it was a week later. Maybe I'm wrong on this. But that following Monday, there would be that national championship game, and then that was the end of the season, and you were done.
Yeah, it had that feel like you talked about earlier of just this individual game was important, even though you're not going to play for a national championship after this game. So I was fascinated by that, and I just remember just reveling in that day and having so much fun with it. But it also led to something else. And again, I'm not advocating for this, Dustin. I'm really not. But I sort of kind of miss co-national champions.
Oh, boy. You missed the bulls and poles.
Yeah, it was a way that – now, this is coming from a Penn State fan who – Penn State has come out on the short end. I mean, they had – undefeated years and didn't win national championship, didn't get the opportunity because of the tie-ins between conferences and bowl games. You know, if it were a Big Ten or Pac-10 team that was number one in the country, well, Penn State was not allowed to go as an independent to those games and play for it. Ironically, right after they joined the Big Ten, they win the conference championship, end up going to the Rose Bowl, which prevents them from going to another game and playing Nebraska for the actual national championship. And Penn State, in both major polls, Nebraska was selected and Penn State got the short end of the stick on it. But there was something to it. Was almost like most years, if there's an argument for two teams, it's like the polls got together. I guess one was the coaches, one was the sports writers. One would vote for one team and the other would vote for the other team, you know. So yeah, they both got that national championship, which I, you know, in hindsight, I don't think that was the worst thing in the world. Let's still argue whether Penn State or Nebraska was the better team in 94.
Right, right. And then what was it, Michigan and Nebraska in 97? Is that the year, I think?
I'm not sure. I know Michigan the year when BYU won it, did they share with somebody also? I'd have to look it up. I don't remember. Yeah. But yeah, I think Michigan, there was a year where they shared it.
Yeah, I mean, people still debate some of those things to this day, right? So it did make it fun. But like, again, I think when you had that, it stressed the importance of every – so you looked at every game independently, right? You couldn't slip up. And so that was – yeah, I actually didn't hate that. I mean, people now would probably throw a complete fit and a tirade. But that was, you know, for a very – I don't remember them well, but I do remember shared national championships, and that, like, you know, I'm sure there was controversy, but there's controversy now. Should this team have gotten in? Should that team have gotten in? You know, there's always going to be controversy no matter how you do it. So, yeah, that was, I would, if there was one thing that, I mean, we would like a lot of things to come back, right? But that was, that wasn't the worst thing in the world.
It wasn't. And I think it's, again, I'm the guy who I literally wrote a paper in college on why there should be a playoff. Okay. So that tells you how long I've advocated for it, Dustin. and I guess I still do, but it doesn't change the fact that I miss these things. You know, it's like when we talked about the tie game, I don't necessarily want to advocate for it, but I also wonder, you know, especially with a 12-team or perhaps one day a 24-team playoff, would a tie game in the regular season really be so harmful?
No, I mean, we see it in the NFL. Not all the time, not frequently, but there are ties in the NFL, and it doesn't, you know, maybe it impacts a team making the playoffs or not, but once you're in the playoffs, it doesn't affect you. So, yeah, I mean, and especially now with how long games are. I mean, I know they've changed the overtime rules, but how long the seasons are. If you just said, we're going to play four quarters, now fans would be pissed. They want their money's worth. I'm sorry, I probably can't say that. Fans would
you
be
upset. It's all right.
But, yeah, I mean, I think that would be – I mean, yeah, there's a lot of old things, a lot of the nostalgia factor, too. And the other thing, too, about this, Jim, is when you had split national – if you didn't have those two teams playing in the national – or, you know, in a bowl game together, you could have – let's say it's – let's say it's Ohio State and Oklahoma and Nebraska and, you know, Penn State. If Ohio State and Nebraska are the two teams that are competing, you know, trying to get those votes, well, then that game means something to Penn State too. You can not only win the Orange Bowl, but then you can prevent Nebraska from winning it all, right?
That's exactly it. You watch with a lot of interest in those other bowl games. All right, that has to be it, Dustin. Thank you, Dusty. Thank all of you for tuning in. Make sure you join us next time on the Keystone Kickoff Show.
Welcome to the new HVU Insider, Penn State football's fan scouting platform providing exclusive recruiting intel, the first of its kind platform giving Penn State fans an inside look at how the Nittany Lions identify, evaluate, and recruit the next generation of talent, led by Mike B and powered by Penn State students. It's a new era of Penn State football under Coach Matt Campbell. You can sign up at happyvalleyunited.com. It's fast and free.